Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhouseonline.com.au.
Chuck Colson has tasted power. As special counsel for US President Richard Nixon between 1969 and 73, he was known as Nixon's hatchet man, a hard-headed political player adept at getting party politics through. Colson's also experienced public humiliation. He was the first person jailed in relation to the Watergate scandal of 1974. His life had an abrupt turnaround, though, just before entering prison, with the personal discovery of Christian faith. And since that time, he has founded Prison Fellowship Ministries, the largest outreach to convicts, victims of crime, and justice officers in the world. And he applies his significant intellect to comment on political and spiritual issues of the day from the Christian worldview. His many books include Born Again, Loving God, The Good Life, and How Now Shall We Live, a book which has been quite influential on me personally. It's been quite some time coming, but I'm glad to say Chuck Colson is on the line. Chuck Colson, welcome to Open House.
Well, Sheridan, thank you. I'm delighted to be here. I've had many wonderful experiences down under in the years that I've been traveling in ministry, some great times in your prisons, and I think there's probably no place in the world where I've felt more warmly welcomed than in Australia.
Well, that warmth is extended to you tonight as well. You got involved in politics really quite early. What was the attraction for you back then?
Oh, actually, when I was in school, I studied political philosophy, and I just had a passion for politics. I followed all the campaigns, and I actually volunteered in some when I was a kid. Mm. And I was just fascinated with the whole notion that you could change society, and so I was very idealistic. I went in the Marine Corps and served my country, and then immediately went to law school nights and worked days and worked my way into a pretty significant job politically when I was in my 30s. I was administrative assistant to a senior United States senator. And then Richard Nixon was elected president, and I had gotten to know him and had great admiration for him. He asked me to be his special counsel. So at age 38, I went to the White House and ended up after very short time, less than a year, in the office next to the president. I was one of his senior aides. Mm. So my life was the American dream come true. You work hard. I came from humble background. Work hard, get the education you can, first person in my family to go to college, and then to law school, and succeed. Success was everything, and power was everything, and I was driven by it. And then I ended up in the office next to the president. My immigrant grandparents never could have imagined that their grandson would be there.
Yes. It was actually said of you, of your life back then, that you would run down your own grandmother to get Richard Nixon re-elected. Slate magazine, the American magazine, described you as the, quote, evil genius of the Nixon regime. And elsewhere you've been described as Nixon's, quote, hatchet man. How fair are those statements of you back then?
Oh, my goodness. During the Watergate, when the whole scandal erupted, I was one of the closest men to the president, and I never gave press interviews, so I was a wonderful target. Hmm. I also did a lot of the president's tough jobs. You know, he'd have to fire somebody. I was the one that did it. He was going to attack an opponent. I would be the one that would go out and do it. So, sure, I was the former Marine captain, said yes, sir, and get the job done. He's told an associate, I think it ended up in the press, Chuck Colson's so tough he just walked through doors if he needed to get something done. So that was my reputation. Yeah. I never really said I'd run over my own grandmother. Someone said that about me, and it got picked up and picked up and around the world.
Yeah.
And so it probably characterized my personality. My parents didn't like the fact that I was running over my grandmother, but it captured the tough guy. I was the tough guy.
And why were you the tough guy? I mean, why were you so politically driven and you know, maybe even a little bit ruthless in
places?
Well,
it was very idealistic. I had a passion. I wanted to change the world. And I think what really led to my conversion and what led to my later life is the fact that after 4 years in the White House, having engineered what was at that point the largest landslide ever for a president reelected, Richard Nixon, when it was all over, I kind of looked out my window of my office and looked at the beautifully manicured lawn, south lawns of the White House, and I thought, what do you do after this? Have I really changed anything? I had the strangest sensation when that election in 1972 was over and I could go back to my law firm where I was making a lot of money. Mm. I could have gone into the cabinet. I could have done anything I wanted at that point, and yet, for the first time in my life, I felt a complete deadness, because I couldn't really think about how anything I'd done had any lasting significance. I mean, I got the president reelected. And then Watergate came along, which was a very depressing experience because being attacked and accused of all sorts of things, some of which later were proven true, most of which were not, but it was a time of political convulsions in Washington. And I remember one day in the spring of 1973, I left the White House, I went back to my law firm, and I was going to resume my practice, which was, I had clients standing in line to come see me. I was very successful and a very hot item, but I didn't feel very good. And I went back to one of the clients I'd had before I went to practice law. I hadn't seen him in 4 years. And I walked in his office, and I'd been told he changed. He'd had an experience. I didn't know what the experience was. So I said to him, and he was. He was totally different. He was at peace and calm and asked questions about me. And so I finally said to him, Tom, what's happened to you? You're different. Because he was a guy just like I was, hard-charging, drove to the top, became president of the largest corporation in New England. And he looked at me with expressionless, and he simply said, I've accepted Jesus Christ and committed my life to him. Sheridan, I have to tell you, I had to take a firm grip on the bottom of the chair. I'd have fallen off. I'd never heard anyone talk that way. I grew up in a part of America which is not the Bible Belt, and you went to church once in a while, and you were a Christian. I thought I was a Christian because I grew up in America. It's a Christian country. Mm-hmm. I wasn't Jewish. I must be Christian.
Mm-hmm.
So I really didn't have any idea what he was talking about, but it provoked me. I started thinking about it. And over those next months, I kept wondering, what is that man talking about? As Watergate, the crisis of Watergate deepened, and I found myself more and more in trouble, or threatened with trouble, I went back to him one night, a very warm summer night in 1973, at his home just outside of Boston, Mass. And I said, Tom, tell me what's happened to you. And he, before he would, he read me a little book, a chapter out of a little book written by C.S. Lewis. The book was entitled Mere Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about pride, and I always thought I was doing all these good things for the country and for my family. That night I was so deeply convicted, it was all pride, it was all about me. And I felt about 2 inches high. I felt horrible, I felt convicted. And then Tom told me how he'd accepted Christ at a Billy Graham crusade in New York and had become a Christian, and how his life had changed, how he'd gone through a period of soul-searching just like I had. That night I left him. He wanted to pray with me, but I'd never prayed except in church. I walked out of his house, and I got to my automobile, and I looked around. I almost went back because I wanted to ask him to pray. But I saw the lights going out in the house, so I didn't. I drove the car out of the driveway, but I didn't get more than 100 meters before I had to stop and cry. I was crying my eyes out. I was calling out to God, and probably the first honest prayer I'd ever prayed in my life. And I was there probably by the side of that road for an hour, maybe more, just thinking about my life and thinking how much I desperately wanted what he had. And I wanted to know God. And I thought I'd wake up the next morning because I was the tough ex-Marine captain, White House hatchet man, tough guy. I never cried, and here I was crying. And I thought I'd wake up the next morning embarrassed, and instead I had this wonderful feeling. And I started reading. I read Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis, the great British thinker and scholar and apologist to the Christian faith. And I was convicted by that book. And in the quiet of my own prayers, I asked Christ into my life. And I have to tell you, Sheridan, from that day, which is now, 37 years ago,
that's right,
to today, my life has never been the same, can never be the same again.
No.
And I knew I was a different person. The world didn't. There was much scoffing and I kept the cartoonist of America clothed and fed for a month.
Yeah.
When the story of my conversion got out, everybody was saying, Chuck Colson, no way. And it made headline news. It was 5 minutes lead network news story in all three networks in the United States. I guess it was a pretty improbable story.
Yeah,
but all I could say to the cynics and skeptics back then is, well, wait and see. And I've spent the last 37 years working in the bowels of society in prisons, bringing the gospel, the good news of Jesus Christ, that you can have a new life in Christ, that you can be forgiven for your sins, bringing that to prisoners all around the world. And I've seen the same phenomenon everywhere. These are the dregs of society. These are people that are cast-offs. These are people nobody cares about. And I've seen them, big, burly guys with muscular arms and hairy legs and arms, just break down and cry like babies.
Yeah.
It's true. It's undeniable.
It's changed your life, and it's changing lives all around the world through the work that you've been doing. This is Open House across the nation. Chuck Colson is with us. Of course, originally connected so closely to the Richard Nixon administration, then the Watergate scandal, and these days, Prison Fellowship, an organization that serves prisoners and victims of crime, justice officers, right around the world. I want to get to a prison fellowship and your the way that grew out of your prison time in just a second, Chuck. Just to wrap up the Watergate scandal moment, though. I mean, just what... With the passing of time, I think many people have actually forgotten what Watergate was all about and just how big a scandal it actually was. I mean, there was Democratic headquarters break-ins and President Nixon found to be secretly recording telephone conversations. What exactly was your part in the scandal?
Well, what I did was to give to the newspapers information about Daniel Ellsberg. That name will not mean much to any Australians listening, but he was an employee of the government, handling top secret papers, who released the Pentagon papers. Interestingly enough, one of the items released in that was some back channel cables with the Australian government. Your government was infuriated by this. It was a serious national security leak, and we went after him. We went after him to discredit him in the press. I did, and that was later deemed to be interference in his trial, or called obstruction of justice. Actually, Watergate was a series of stupid things, breaking into the Democratic National Committee to bug their telephones. You don't gain anything that way. It was absolutely, most of the things that were done were idiotic. And when I heard about them, I thought, we couldn't have been so stupid, but we were. Pride again, hubris. Yeah. But what really brought us down was the cover-up, the fact that Nixon, when he found out what was really going on, and I was one of the first to tell him what was going on, when he saw what was going on, he didn't expose the wrongdoers. He kept denying that anybody had done anything wrong. So eventually, that's what brought him down. When it was disclosed, because telephone conversations he had recorded, when it was disclosed that he knew about it in advance and he tried to cover it up, he lost the moral authority of the government and it started an impeachment process. And he resigned before the impeachment process was over. Meanwhile, I had become a Christian, and I decided I couldn't live with being a Christian and being in the public eye as one of the rogues, the public enemy number one out of Watergate. I couldn't make a clear witness, and I knew I was going to be tied up in trials for a few years. I didn't think I was guilty of what I'd been charged with, at least. But I walked in the prosecutor's office one day, and I said, look, no deals, no bargains. I won't testify against anybody else, but I'm willing to plead guilty to this. And I did, mainly to get it behind me, and I went to prison. Ironically, I went to prison a free man because it was behind me, and I could live as a Christian, and little did I realize it then, Sheridan, but that time in prison was the most important time possible for me, because 7 months I studied a lot of scripture, I started a little Bible studies in prison, and I had a deep conviction that God wanted me to do something for the prisoners, so came out of prison and started Prison Fellowship, which is now in 130 countries around the world.
Yeah, in fact, when you left the correctional facilities, there was a couple of them, but I think the majority of the time was in Alabama, wasn't it, the Maxwell correctional facility there?
Right.
You vowed to inmates that you would, quote, never forget those behind the bars. I mean, what did you actually see that made you realize that something needed to be done and, in fact, you know, a prison fellowship needed to be birthed?
Well, the dreadful thing about prisons, and it's true in Australia, it's true in every country I've been in, you're taking a piece of a person's life, you're taking away his freedom, and you're confining him, and it's a horrible experience. Human beings aren't made to be put in cages. And what happens is I saw men lying on their bunks, staring into the emptiness, trying to sleep the time away, and literally their souls corroding and their bodies atrophying. It's a terrible thing. There's nothing for them to do. There's no purpose. But I also saw, when we started this prayer group, that when they came to Christ, when they were really converted, they became new people, and they had hope and a reason to live. And so what I realized was the prison system isn't working. It is not reforming people. 60% of the people that get out of prison in America are rearrested within the first 3 years. So it's not working. And I realized that when I left prison. I also realized that the gospel does change their lives. And I really didn't want to start a ministry because I didn't want to be in full-time ministry. And I had a lot of other offers in business. But I did it because I felt they needed somebody to bring this good news to them. And I thought I could get it started and then leave it to somebody else. Well, it didn't work that way. I've been doing it for 35 years.
Yeah, there you are. It's been keeping on going. And it's done amazing things, isn't it? I mean, all the kind of little programs that have sprouted out of Prison Fellowship, the Inner Change Program, the Angel Tree Program. A lot of this revolves around restorative justice as well, the fact that you try and, as much as possible, bring victims and perpetrators together, or at least allow the perpetrators to see the emotional and other impacts of what they have done on victims as well, which is really interesting given the fact that you are from the right side of politics, Republicans, and a lot of the things that you've actually championed, some would actually quote-unquote say these are kind of more leftish kind of issues. Of course, they're neither when it comes to the Christian message anyway, but it's interesting how you have pioneered programs that really have taken compassion on prisoners and led them to change.
I'm a conservative, but it doesn't mean as a conservative that I don't have compassion. I have great compassion for people. I care for them deeply. What I don't believe in is big government solutions for problems, and prisons is the ultimate big government solution for problems. I believe in the church getting involved and trying to take care of these people, get them out of prison, get them back on their feet. I think that's a thoroughly conservative perspective on life. And I also see that we live our lives by revealed truth. We live our lives by the way God teaches us. Most of the problems in the world today are caused by liberals who believe in ideology, that is, man-made solutions. So they come up with these great utopian schemes, but through history, utopian schemes have always led to tyranny. The way people need to order their lives together is according to the moral order that God has shown us in the universe. When you live it, but that's a conservative perspective because it means I care about those who have gone before me. I stand on the shoulders of the giants of the faith who preceded me. I am humble enough to believe that I can't answer these questions, but only God can. And so it gives you modest expectations about what you can accomplish. And it teaches you to respect the wisdom of those who have gone before you and the revelation of God in his scriptures.
Yes.
That's a conservative view, but it leads me, drives me into the prisons. It drives me to help the defenseless. It drives me to defend life, particularly because life on the margins of society, those are the people most vulnerable.
Yes, yes. And for those who aren't aware of Prison Fellowship, just paint a picture of some of the dramatic change you've seen in people's lives, and even in prisons. I mean, you've seen whole prisons really transformed as a result of Prison Fellowship's work.
Well, I was just doing an article on my experiences in Northern Ireland back in 1983 when we were there in the Mayes prison. We were working with Catholics and Protestants, and they were being converted to Christ through our ministry, and then there was a dramatic moment when one of the leading Protestant Ulster Defence League terrorists was converted, and an Irish Republican Army Catholic lad was converted, and they became friends in prison. And then we brought him out one night for a big public rally in Belfast, and the two of them stood there, arms around one another, and one of them said, if I'd met Jimmy in the street a couple of years ago, I'd have killed him. Today, he's my brother in Christ. I'd lay my life down for him. 800 people got up in tears. Now, that movement started in the prisons in 1983. It spread out of the prisons into church groups. And just 2 months ago or 6 weeks ago, the newly elected Prime Minister of England, David Cameron, expressed apologies for Bloody Sunday.
Yes.
And the relations between the Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland have been healed. So I've seen amazing things come out of prisons. And there's one prison we run in the United States, modeled after one we started many, many years ago in Brazil. It's called the IFI, the Interchange Freedom Initiative. We've had studies done by the University of Pennsylvania, which find that in our program, we get an 8% repeat offender rate, 8%, as against 60% nationally, 20% in the control group. So we're demonstrating that while the prisons don't work and they're a very expensive solution, that restorative justice, the idea of getting the offender to understand the consequences of what he has done and make reparation, restitution if possible, and come to Christ and have his heart transformed, we can get those people out of prison, keep them out of prison.
Yes.
They can become leaders of the church.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And also, I mean, you will work with prisoners, whether they come to Christian faith or not as well, which kind of also, even though, of course, you're a great conviction, and I would be right there with you, that real change happens within the heart, when the actual heart has had a supernatural transformation through the Christian gospel. But you also will work with people who don't, you know, cross over to the Christian faith, which also kind of reflects the fact that you believe that service should be given to all, no matter what faith as well.
Absolutely. I mean, if somebody's in trouble and they're hurting, they're suffering, I'm going to help them. I'm not going to ask them what religion they are. I'm going to help them because they're suffering. I also I've had enough experience to realize that the way you really transform a life is through the power of the gospel, which changes the human will, changes your desire from the things that so attract us and tempt us in the world to a desire to live a more righteous life. And I look back at my last 35 years and I realize I couldn't imagine going back to where I was before. It's so much more fulfilling. It is so much more rewarding. It's not any easier. All the same bad things happen in life. You have all the same problems. You get sick like everybody else. But you've got a meaning and a purpose that you couldn't have had any other way.
Yeah.
So I love to introduce people to this. We bring non-Christians in, and it's really interesting. Sometimes we see they're developing their character in accountability groups with Christian believers. We see them actually changing as human beings, even if they remain Muslims or non-believers. The accountability of the intimate relationship of other people, which is one of the fruits of the Christian faith, affects them. Even if they haven't made a religious commitment, they're still a gaining.
Mm-hmm.
So we belong in the business as Christian people of helping others, all others, regardless of their religious faith. They're
yes.
all made in the image of God. They're mm-hmm. all equal. But we believe the Christian faith, when you understand it, is a wonderful proposal. I mean, it's so attractive. I can't imagine how people can live without it. So.
Yeah.
That's why I'd like to share it with everybody who listens.
That's right, and that's your conviction. Open House is what you're listening to right across the nation. Charles Colson is with us, founder of Prison Fellowship. And, of course, you know, you might remember back in the 70s and the connection there with the Watergate scandal. If you've missed half of our conversation, don't forget to download it tomorrow from openhouseonline.com.au. The Christian worldview is the phrase that could really wrap up a lot of what we've been talking about, Chuck. And that's been a major kind of contribution that you've been focusing really the last maybe 10, 15 years of writing towards. I mean, one of the books that you've written that's been most influential on me is How Now Shall We Live, where you talk about the Christian gospel, the Christian worldview. It's actually bigger than just the gospel, the Christian worldview. As the worldview that best makes sense of the world. Now, how did you cotton onto the idea that this really is the key?
That's a very good question, Sheridan. And by the way, if you read How Now Shall We Live and liked it, that means you're a very serious Christian, because that's a heavy book.
600 pages.
it's a tough book. I wouldn't recommend that to people listening who don't know much about Christianity. I'd recommend a book I call The Faith, which is being sold in Australia, and a book called The Good Life, which I think is available in Australia.
Yes, it is.
Or Born Again, my original spiritual memoirs, I would recommend. But let me just respond to your question, because it's a really good one. Christianity is not simply a personal experience or a private experience where you go to church, you now follow Christ, you're going to change your life, live a good life. It's not about that. It's not about you. It's about God. And Christianity and the Bible speak to every single aspect of life. It speaks to caring for the poor. It speaks for human rights because, listen, the most important thing the Christian faith ever brought to the Western world, when the Jews and then the Christians invaded the Greco-Roman Empire, slavery was rampant. Women were abused. It was a very corrupt society. Along came the Christians with this radical doctrine that all men are created in the image of God and are therefore endowed with these rights. And that's why the Christians became opponents of slavery. They became opponents of abortion in the first century and spoke out on the subject. That's why they cared for poor and suffering people. That's why they stayed there through the plagues, which swept through the Roman Empire, and the Christians stayed and took care of the sick. Christianity is the most humanizing influence in Western history. And it remains that today. People always think, well, Christians are talking about politics, so they're trying to cram their views down my throat. No, we're simply saying, here's a way to live that really is decent, it's rewarding, it's fulfilling, it's serving God, it's serving your fellow man. And you too can have this, because
yes.
it's a gift from God.
And it makes sense of the world as well, too. It actually makes sense of beauty and the order that we find in science. And it makes sense of so much that we actually experience.
Yeah, you really can't live in this. You really can't live contrary to the moral order, because, as one of my friends says, it's like cutting against the grain of the universe. It is like coloring outside the lines or spitting into the wind. There's a moral order the way we're supposed to live, and as soon as we figure out what that is, we can make sense of our lives, otherwise we don't. Now, you asked me how I got into it. I'll tell you this quickly before I have to leave. But I worked in the prisons for many years, and I noticed that the prisons were exploding. When I got out of prison in the United States, there were 229,000 people in prison. lives, I started to study the cause of crime, and I read all the sociologists of the 19th century and the 20th century. And the general consensus was crime is caused by poverty, environment, lack of education, racism, I mean, all the conventional social ills that you hear about. And then I discovered two Jewish psychiatrists who did a 17-year longitudinal study on the cause of crime. Their names were Samenow and Yokelson. And they said, no, crime is not caused by any of these things. They started out thinking it was. But their empirical data convinced them that it was caused by people making wrong moral choices. And these are their words now as Jews. They said, and the answer to crime is the conversion of the wrongdoer to a more responsible lifestyle. Hmm. 5 years later, a study came out at Harvard finding the cause of crime was the lack of moral training during the morally formative years. It hit me suddenly that the real problem here is we have a false worldview. We are taking secular values. We have taken God out of our society, and we've lost our moral moorings. We've broken the family down because the family's shattered in America, tragically. I hope it's not as bad in Australia.
It's pretty bad.
And these kids are being raised in single-parent families with no male role models, so they end up going in the gangs. Well, that to me is a worldview problem, and so that's when I started writing. That was in the early 90s. I sort of felt like God had given me two great callings. One is to go into the prisons and do the work and bring people to Christ and restorative justice, at the same time talking about what is the fundamental cause of crime, and that is the collapse of moral ethics and yes. values in our society.
Yes. Chuck, I'd love you to make this a little bit more concrete. Of course, the secular humanist worldview would be probably the majority one that those in the Western world would actually be, I guess, living with without us really even realizing it. Just before we let you go, can you just give us a brief crash course in how the Christian worldview, you know, shows up the weaknesses of the secular humanist worldview?
I'd love to do it. There are four great questions that all human beings ask. Where did I come from? Why is this sin and suffering? Is there a way out of it? What's my purpose in life? The secularist says we came out of the primordial soup. Cells collided, random collision of molecules, and a single cell was formed. And it grew as a plant out of the sea. And from that, we have, through billions of years of mutations and chance, random mutations at that, we have evolved into the sophisticated human beings we are now. I don't have enough faith to believe that. The Christian worldview says we were created by God, spoken into existence by Him, that He is sovereign over all of our lives, that He has a purpose for it. I find great comfort in that. I also find that there's no basis for law if you just believe in the secular or materialist worldview because there's no transcendent authority.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way you could have an ethical system without transcendent authority in life. So a world without God is a world that's adrift. And if we are just the product of atoms, chance collision of molecules, why should I care about anybody else as a human being? I go into the prisons because they're all created in the image of God just like I am. So the answer to the first question, if you answer that wrong, there's no human dignity. Second question is, why is there sin and suffering? That's a question always thrown at Christians, because if there's a good God and He's all-powerful, why does He allow this suffering? Well, suffering is brought about by us because in the biblical account, we were given a free will. We could choose to follow God's ways or not. We chose not to. And human nature has been bent ever since towards doing the wrong thing. We know what's right, but we do what is wrong, as the Bible says. And people know this to be so. If anybody questions whether the Christian doctrine of the fall is correct, just look at the 3,500 years of recorded human history.
That's right.
Sin, suffering, wars. We bring this on ourselves. But the third question, is there a way out? God does not leave us in that condition. He says He loves us so much that He sent His Son, Jesus Christ, to die on a cross in payment of my sins. When I realized that, when I learned that, when I grasped that, my life was transformed immediately. Mm-hmm. And it gave me an incredible sense of gratitude to God, which makes me, in gratitude for what He's done for me, want to serve Him. So I now have a purpose in life. So when you say, what's the purpose? I live in a wonderful retirement community here in the United States. I'm not retired by a long shot. I'm working day and night. But it's a beautiful, beautiful community I live in. Everybody comes down here when they're 65. They think they're going to play golf and live in perfect bliss. And they all start drinking too much. They look bored. And they begin to lose their interest in life. People have to have a purpose.
Yeah.
Why? Because we're not an accidental collision of atoms. We are created in the image of God, and He gives us a purpose. So once you answer those four questions and you compare the answers, I can't imagine why anybody wouldn't take the biblical answers. The biblical answers give you meaning, dignity, salvation from sins, an explanation and an answer to the sin problem and question, and a purpose. And the secular life says simply that you're the result of random materialistic processes. You have no dignity. There's terrible sin and suffering, and there's nothing you can do about it. Various religions come up with schemes and philosophies like Marxism, throw off your chains. The problem is economic oppression. Well, that's always led to tyranny. And then your purpose, I watch people without purpose dying. I watch people with purpose getting up every morning, as I do at 78 years old, excited and thrilled about my life.
Mm.
So that's where the biblical worldview is so distinct. And when you compare them, I'm perfectly prepared to say this. If I were in Australia now and we had time, I'd go on your radio as long as you wanted, and I would make this proposition to people. I would say the biblical worldview, the presupposition that God is, makes sense, and I can show you why it is rational in every respect. Show me any other worldview, secularism or Hinduism or mysticism or atheism, and I'll show you why it's irrational. I can prove it.
Well, I want to take you up on that one day, Chuck.
I'd love to do it.
Well, if we can get you into the studio next time, we'll give you a whole hour, absolutely.
Well, Sheridan, it's been really good to talk to you. Yeah. I have such wonderful, warm memories of my times in Australia and the great people. I love the Australians. So I miss it. I can't travel overseas anymore. I've got so much to do here, and I'm spending all of my time on something called the ColsonCenter.org, which uh-huh. people can get on a website or internet, and teaching people. I'm trying to teach others to teach worldview like I've been teaching it. So
yes.
That's really how I'm concentrating my time right
yeah.
now.
Well, it's been wonderful talking to Charles Colson. Really appreciate your time and all the work that you've actually been doing, and the outworking of that changed life that happened to you back in that Watergate scandal period back in the 70s. Yeah, that's it. Thanks so much for your time, Charles.
Well, God bless you and your work, Sheridan. I've enjoyed it, and they've been good questions and fun talking with you.
Yeah, you too.
God bless you.
Chuck Colson there, founder of Prison Fellowship. What an amazing story and what an amazing conviction.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit openhouseonline.com.au.